If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. As a recruiter, you are worthy and you are worthwhile. Nobody has done more to help promote the value of recruitment than my next guest.
We have to shout about the good things that recruiters do. You know, you'll see a lot of stories about people who've managed to do well after losing their job and they find another job. The recruiter doesn't get enough credit.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. Recently, I had the great pleasure to interview Dee Dee Doak. Dee Dee is the editor-in-chief of Recruiter Magazine, the UK's leading publication for the recruitment industry.
The AI agents, you know, depending on the cost, that's going to have some effect. Does that mean that there's going to be downward pressure on the salaries of consultants?
What you're about to hear is a podcast interview that I conducted live in person at the Recruitment Agency Expo in London. Dee Dee and I had a really interesting conversation about the value of recruitment industry, as well as doing business in the USA from the lens of the UK recruitment industry.
But in the US, I don't think staffing and recruiting has the stature that it's gaining in the UK. I believe that it is really becoming and has become a much more respected advisory professional service than it is in the States.
Dee Dee Doak, how are you?
I am really well, thanks, Mark. How are you?
Fantastic. Welcome. I'm so glad we're finally doing this. Long overdue.
Well, I am too. I'm really honored to have been asked. Thank you.
This is a fun one because we're recording it in person at the Recruitment Agency Expo in London.
Yes.
And so it's kind of a special one for us to do together. I say long overdue because I think we've known each other for almost 20 years now.
Oh my gosh.
because I don't know if you remember, we first met in Glasgow. It would have been, I don't know, 2008, 2009, something like that.
At one of our roundtable events.
Recruiter there. Magazine roundtable
yes.
event. Yep.
Yes.
And then we have met a couple of times since then, but not for a long time.
No. We haven't had a really good catch-up.
Exactly. So let's do that now. So
yes.
You have, I'm excited about this one because you've been the editor-in-chief at Recruiter Magazine for, what, 20 plus years?
20.
20?
In May, it will be 20 years.
Wow.
I can't believe it.
So Recruiter Magazine is the industry publication for the UK recruitment industry. And you are such an amazing advocate for the industry. Just excited to, I've got lots of things I want to ask you. So I hope you're ready.
Good. Ask away.
All right. Fantastic. So before we dive into like the issues of the day, I'm curious, like what brought, because you're American from Seattle, what brought you to the UK?
Well, this may sound kind of funny, but my parents brought me here on holiday when I was 5.
Okay.
And I knew then that I wanted to live here. I just loved it.
Wow, since you're 5.
And I didn't get to until some years later, but I was working for an American newspaper that was based in Europe. Well, around the globe, actually. And I finally was able to kick and scream my way into getting the UK Bureau. And I loved it. And then a few years later, I got headhunted by an aviation magazine because I had a strong knowledge of aviation and the U.S. Air Force. And so my career in my real UK career started with Flight International.
Cool. And what was it about the UK that attracted you all those years ago when you were five?
There was an ambience, you know. Granted, my parents will have taken me just to the, you know, real touristy spots.
Sure.
But there was a buzz. Just felt so alive. And even then, I loved the culture. My parents were they were big theater people. And they took me, even at that age, to the theater.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And we went lots of great places. There's just always been an affinity there.
So I have those childhood memories of London as well, because my dad is from London. And we lived in Canada, but we would do every maybe 4 or 5 years, we would do a family trip to London to visit relatives and stuff. So I also have those kind of snapshots in my memory
banks. Did you feel that?
Yeah, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you a dual citizen now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, same.
And a very proud one.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So that's a good stepping off point because you've kind of got that international perspective of UK and US. And it's interesting because although we're based here, 80% of our clients are American now.
Wow.
And with the podcast as well, that's got a global audience. But our biggest listenership is the US.
Wow.
So
what kind of sector in the US?
So it's all recruitment, staffing, exec search.
Oh,
firms.
I mean industry.
Like industry of people listening or
a sector. Yeah. The ones that are they in financial services?
Oh, I see. It's across the board, everything from aerospace, defense, AI, nursing, you know, the typical accounting, tech. It's really very diverse.
Oh, that's great.
So our audience tends to be the small and medium-sized recruiting firms. A lot of the owners, directors, founders, and their teams. But typically, we have a lot of like the solopreneurs who listen, and then also the sort of like up to 50 employees type. So that's kind of our core demographic.
And those are the people, I believe, that I may say something controversial.
Okay,
here,
go for it.
But I do think that the SMEs are at the very heart and soul of recruitment, staffing, even executive search.
Yes, for sure. Absolutely. I was just going to ask about the U.S. connection, because you're moderating a panel here tomorrow, which is specifically about doing business in the U.S. in 2025 from the perspective of U.K. recruitment companies.
Yeah.
So why that topic?
I thought it was very timely. We're also going to cover in this session what it's kind of the effects of what's going on in the U.S., even on people who are operating in the U.K. and don't have a U.S., because there are going to be repercussions.
Of course.
Effects.
Yes.
And so we're going to cover some of that as well. I'm really excited about it. The opportunity came along to do a panel, and I thought, we need to do this, and it's very in the news.
Very much. Will. And of course, as a journalist, then you're immersed in what's going on in the news. So, well, let's dive into that first then, if that's okay.
Sure.
So we're living in a very uncertain time. It's strange, Stevie. I don't know. Like, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's sort of unprecedented. And I know we've had almost like 5 years of, you know, craziness
up
with COVID, war in Ukraine and then in Gaza and then, you know, Trump being elected and, you know, the tariffs. And like, it's almost like one shock after another.
Yes. You wake up and think, what's going to happen today?
Exactly. So I guess, first of all, from the point of view of UK recruiters, who, what do you think are going to be the impacts of the changes in the US economy on Britain?
Well, you know, there's that old saying, if the US sneezes, then the UK catches a cold.
Right.
And I think we're still in early days to know precisely what will happen. But there's the issue of the tariffs. This morning, I read that Keir Starmer is going to plead with the U.S. about the tariffs. So we don't know what's going to happen there. Switching to a bit of a people issue, we don't know who's going to get deported from the U.S.
Right.
Also, with all of their DEI programs being dismantled, what effect will that have, say, on the LGBT and A population?
Right.
And that's what one of our guests, Matt Cameron, is going to address tomorrow. But, you know, are there any protections anymore? Are there not? What can a responsible business do?
I think that's it, is like the not knowing, you're on shifting sand, right? And if one way or another, if people just knew whether you liked the policy or not,
right,
you would know the lay of the land. But now it seems like everything's up in the air. I have a friend in Atlanta who works for the government, and she has to send these daily or weekly emails on what she's accomplished that week.
Yes.
But also, she is not, she had to take the rainbow sticker off her car. Otherwise, she couldn't use the staff parking lot, which just kind of is craziness, right? So, but from a, so that's the people side of it. But from a, I like the analogy of US, you know, sneezes and UK catches cold. Have you heard of any specific impacts yet in terms of like for UK recruitment businesses?
Not so much yet.
Yeah.
Although, again, going back to the people thing, I think visas are going to become a more confrontational kind of issue.
Yeah.
Maybe for Americans who are here.
Okay.
Or for UK companies who want to send UK citizens over there.
States, yeah.
And, well, even with Irish, you know, recruiters, because the president of the United States is upset also with Ireland at the moment.
I didn't realize.
What happens to them?
Right.
Mergers and acquisition. That's an interesting area right now. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Barrow, who will be very well known to our audiences, is going to address that along with Bilal Khan from BDO.
Okay.
Because there's been a lot of activity in the U.S.
Yeah.
On the M&A front.
Yeah.
Less so here. And there's thought that the deals in the States will continue. But what's going to happen? What will due diligence include?
Got it. Okay.
I wish we had more than half an hour tomorrow because so we'll just have to keep the dialogue going.
Absolutely.
You know?
So are you saying then the in terms of M&A, I mean, the U.S. economy is four times bigger than the U.K., right? And so in terms of the number of deals, there's always going to be a lot more. But are you saying that you're seeing that that should continue in the U.S., but maybe
it is expected to.
Okay.
Now, and this sounds a little bit mean, I guess, but I hope the agencies in the U.S. are also well-placed to help all those government workers.
Right.
Who are out. The number that gets thrown around the most is 100,000 people out of work. Oh, but another number or set of numbers that I heard on Friday from a U.S. source was more in the area of 200,000 to 300,000.
Okay.
So how will those people get jobs?
Absolutely. Yeah.
On a LinkedIn post, I was very cheeky. It was from a U.S. guy who I had encountered through a U.S. friend. And he was let go from the Internal Revenue Service. And I said, well, you might check out HMRC over here because they're going to be hiring all these people.
Yeah.
So maybe any little help we can give them.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. So interesting. What are the other, so you've mentioned the people aspect, you've mentioned the M&A aspect. What are the other strands of this conversation that you're hoping to tease out tomorrow?
Wow. We're starting there and we're just going to fly.
Okay.
The speakers have sent me some lists of points they can get on. You know how it is. You start to talk about one thing and then you end up going in all these other directions. Yeah. But I don't think there is going to be a quiet or a dull moment.
Do you know, are you able to say what the key talking points are going to be from the notes that you've seen so far?
Well, the people aspect.
Yeah.
The M&A aspect. Yeah. The regulatory aspect.
Yeah.
The tariffs.
Yeah.
Of course. So that's the meat as it is right now.
Okay. So our clients who are based in the UK are very interested in doing business in the US for many reasons, which you can guess. The biggest one being that salaries are so much higher than in the UK, as well as, potentially less price sensitivity. So fee percentages are typically higher. So if you combine those two things, then you're placing similar sort of people in similar sort of jobs, but making two or three times bigger of a fee.
Right.
And then the third element is that, strangely, there seems to be less competition in the States than there is in the UK. And so I've heard this figure of there's apparently about 68,000 recruiting and staffing and search businesses in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about 40 or 50,000 in the UK. So there's a similar number of suppliers. But as we said earlier, the economy in the U.S. is so much bigger that it feels like there's more saturation here. And so I think for all those reasons, we have clients who are based here.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't even moved over there. They're just, working a different shift pattern and recruiting and working for clients in the U.S. and able to make more money, but still be based in Scotland or Ireland or England or whatever.
Which is a wonderful thing.
What's your take on that as someone who is, obviously you're the champion of the UK recruitment business, but you have, affiliation to the US as well. What's your, and of course there's been over the last decade, there've been a movement of the bigger recruiting firms kind of landing and expanding in the US as well, but do you think that trend's going to continue or have we maxed out on that?
I think we're seeing right now the bigger firms kind of retracting.
Okay.
I don't know precisely if they're going to retract contract in the U.S., but I kind of suspect they are.
Okay.
I think it will be very interesting to see what happens to the operations that the big ones have in, say, Houston.
Yeah.
Where it's a big oil town, what will happen with, clean energy in that environment? Because, as you know, the U.S. position right now is drill, baby, drill.
Right, yes.
So that may be one place in the world where, not the old technology, but the traditional ones still can play very strongly in the market. Absolutely. I think one thing, though, that sets the UK apart from the US in the recruitment and staffing market, there is so much innovation here.
There's so much innovation.
Innovation, yes. Now, when there is an innovator in the U.S., we hear about it and they usually come over. When there were really big job boards.
Yep.
There were a couple that were really big there and they came here.
Yes.
And they're still kind of here, but they're not the giants on the marketplace that they were. But many recruitment agencies here want to be innovative. They may not be that big. They may not have all that turnover, but they want to do things in a way that's going to help them stand out. Maybe you can thank the saturation for that. American companies, they are innovating, but this is a personal feeling, but it's always so much about scale. You know, this is the biggest, or this is the largest, and so forth. And here, those numbers are so important, but at the same time, it's about, well, we do things a little differently here, you know?
Okay, that's interesting, because you think, America is number one in terms of innovation in science, technology, medicine, and
for the time being.
But I hear what you're saying in terms of there is a real need to differentiate here. And if you pair that with developments in artificial intelligence, I think there's just this feeling like we have to evolve and, incorporate AI into what we're doing, the way we're working, and both to increase efficiency and productivity, but also to differentiate from the competitors, because, and I think the saturation then drives, puts more price pressure, because the client has then the perception, well, it's all the same thing, so I'm going to go with the cheapest.
Yes.
So you have to counteract that by constantly finding ways to, how can we not just say that we're different, because it's easy to say, but how can you demonstrate that you have tangible differentiators that will result in real client benefits? And so that's maybe part of it. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that very much is a part of it. And I think the start, of course, the U.S. has a gigundo startup culture.
Yeah.
But in the U.K., startups are, people don't want to do something in a traditional way. And they want to have their own businesses. And that's a driver, too. I'm very keen at the moment to get some information, to get some insight that I don't currently have about scale-ups.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
Well, I don't know a lot to tell you.
Why are you curious about that particularly?
Because I think we all know many ways to start up a recruitment company. You know, that's it's been handed down through the ages in a lot of ways. But once you've got that company, how do you take it bigger if you want to make it bigger? Or how do you make it more viable? Even, I think viable may be the word for it, because you can go along for a few years and, cover your costs and so forth. But taking that jump to this is a viable business.
Yes.
How do you do that?
And the sustainable growth in earnings, right?
Exactly.
So, and it is, It's hard, DD. Otherwise, everyone would do it, right? It's really hard. And so we actually have two different coaching programs. So we've got the one for the sort of solopreneurs and small shops, like with fewer than five employees. And then we have a smaller but equally important group who are sort of 5 to 50 employees who really are entrepreneurial, want to scale and build that, you know, scale up, as you as you said. And
you need to put me in touch with those guys.
Let's introduce you, because but it is so, it is really hard, because typically what you get is someone who is a good biller themselves and they want to grow a team.
Yes.
And but being a good biller doesn't automatically make you a great leader. And there's new things you have to consider in terms of systems, processes, you know, technology. There's a lot, there's more layers to this, which in order to make it scalable, you can't just replicate yourself.
Right.
Right. And so to be a true business owner, you need to have operations and marketing and strategy and, you know, lots of other elements. However, there's a twist in the tail, Didi, which is up until now, scale-ups, it's been about, well, there's two, there actually, you've got a brilliant, Recruiter Magazine publishes a couple of great, I mean, lots of great stuff, but the things that we pay close attention to, you've got your Hot 100 list. I look at that. It just come out actually recently, the new Hot 100. So which recruiting firms are the most productive in terms of
Net fee income.
Net fee income per fee earner, right? Or per employee. And that's so interesting, because there's really only three ways you can grow your recruiting business. You can increase the fee income per person.
Right.
Or you can increase headcount. Or you can ideally do both. But those two things are hard to do at the same time.
Yes.
Because as you increase headcount, your average income per person tends to go down.
Yes.
Right. And you're using profits to reinvest and hire people, and they're not productive right away because it takes 3 to 6 months and so on and so forth. Right. So, but the twist in the tail this year, Didi, is AI agents, like 2025 supposedly is the year of the AI agent, right? Where we're going to have AI agents who are actually on your org chart and doing work autonomously alongside your actual human team members.
Right.
And so what I'm wondering is whether the idea of just keep adding headcount, maybe that idea has run out of steam and it's going to be much more lean and mean. Obviously, we still need human beings at the heart of your business, but are recruiting firms going to be more efficient and have more AI with fewer people?
Wow. That's a big question. One thing that's related to this, in this month's issue of Recruiter, we have a really good column by Sid Barnes of Mastermind Consulting and Elite Leaders. And he talks about how organizations have been so desperate to get and hang on to people that they're paying them too much to be able to achieve a healthy net fee income.
Yeah.
And I think the AI agents, you know, depending on the cost, that's going to have some effect on that. Does that mean that there is going to be, you know, downward pressure on the salaries of consultants? You know, are the big billers still going to be big billers?
Mm-hmm.
That is a whole interesting area of it.
It's very interesting. And what's your thoughts on how all that's going?
I think many businesses are very wary.
Yeah.
I think we have not seen the big jump yet for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think another attribute that sets UK recruiters apart from the US one, US always wants to be on the next big thing, you know? If it's new in the market, they got to have them.
Okay.
Not so much here. They want to be innovative, but they also want to be innovative in ways on which they're not going to lose money, that they have some indication or tests that say this is going to work for them. So I think the jury is still out on that, but let's talk about that again in 6 months.
Right, exactly. I think there's a sense right now of there's the hype of AI, but then there, what's the actual ROI? And the two are like the ROI is lagging behind the hype, obviously.
Yeah.
But I do think, and it, so is it 6 months or 12 months or 3 years? But sooner or later, right, it's inevitable that AI will replace a lot of these things that,
that
recruiters do in a company. So what that means is that now that can be a good thing because it might free us up from the drudgery.
The admin.
Right. Because recruiters don't, and salespeople don't like admin. They don't like, you know.
No.
So if they can spend more time talking to people, which is
yes.
the part they are best at.
Yes.
Then maybe that's a good thing. But what it does mean is potentially a firm needs fewer of those people to do the work. Yeah. And therefore, I think you may still have your big billers, but they're supported by an army of AI agents and
yes.
then fewer people. I don't know.
That would be, I think, a good kind of a conclusion to that. I think it's like having I think you're making the most of your professionals and you can be very selective about your juniors, you know. There's always a rush to get in these people with no experience doing anything.
Yes.
And you think, well, you know, this will flush them out. It'd be great to be able to be more selective about your juniors, you know, with more potential, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. I did. So that model of these large academies of grads coming into recruitment, and it's a bit of a sausage, like we're putting 10 people in and we expect one or two to come out the other side and actually be successful with a high churn
yes.
rate. Is that the most efficient model? Surely we can do it better than that.
I think so too.
Yeah. Didi, I wanted to ask you, there is no equivalent to Recruiter Magazine in the US.
Right.
Why? And or even events like this, the Recruitment Agency Expo, it seems there are more resources available for recruiters here for the industry. Why is that?
Well, I would argue that there are some big deal events in the States. The staffing and I don't remember their full name, but the U.S. equivalent of the REC.
So there's the, I did know this one. Yeah, I know exactly.
Who you know
yeah.
the one. And they have a headquarters in Washington. And I've been to that one a couple of times. For the in-house people, there's also ERE.
Yeah.
You could say that the resources.
That's more for the, I feel like that's more for talent acquisition people. I feel like, and for recruitment agencies, I've not seen any equivalent to Recruiter Magazine over there.
No. And I'm very pleased about that.
Have you not thought about expanding across the pond?
Oh, I'd love to tell my publisher that. No, but I would love to. I think, obviously, I love magazines. I love publications. But I think there is a space for one. People like to have something they can go to and look at it.
Definitely.
And feel like they're maybe a bit more in the know. Or they're, it can be aspirational, you know. But in the U.S., I don't think staffing and recruiting has the stature that it's gaining in the U.K. You know, I believe that it is really becoming and has become a much more respected advisory professional service kind of sector than it is in the States. In the States, headhunters get there's a headhunter event too, I think. There's a lot around headhunters because they wear suits, you know, and they work with corporates. But the staffing and recruiting, I don't even see as much pride in the industry there at the recruiter level that there is here.
Interesting. So I know that's something that you, in your position as the editor of Recruiter Magazine, you've done such a brilliant job of instilling that, like, promoting and advancing the idea that this is a worthwhile industry and it's a profession you can be proud of. Can you say more about, first of all, like, why do you think recruiters don't always believe in their own value? And then what would you say to counteract that?
A lot of people get into recruitment for the money.
Sure.
The money is very good. Yeah. And I think, though, at the same time, you can look at making a lot of money and think, what did I do to deserve this?
Okay.
You know, I may have all this money, but what's my stature? You know, does anyone want to grow up to be like me?
Right.
And I think we have to create those people. I think, you know, for young people, well, even I think career changers, because I think there are a lot of career changers out there who could be great recruiters.
Sure.
But just haven't thought about it enough. I think the more the profession is professionalized, you know, and that sounds kind of trite, but it's about having high standards for the agency you run, the way you do your job, the way your colleagues do their job. But I think standards have to be linked to pay. Okay. I think it has to be linked to the service you provide. You know, are you knowledgeable? Are you expert at placing these kinds of people? I've always felt, and I know there's a lot of disagreement here, that having a certification in recruitment can be valuable. I think it can be, you know, pumped up a bit. That's not the only answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the REC and APSCO both do credentialing program. With APSCO, they've even tried to take it into the university.
Got a degree now, actually. Yeah, I was speaking to Ann Swain about that. Yeah.
And that is marvelous. But we need to shout about that more. We have to shout about the good things that recruiters do. You know, you'll see a lot of stories, well, not a lot, but some out there in the media about people who've managed to do well after losing their job and they find another job. The recruiter doesn't get enough credit in those stories. You know, how do you get those people into work? What have you done? And take away some of the mystique about it. There has to be a black book. You know, everyone needs a black book. But at the same time, I think if the mass public understood the work that it takes to find the right job or the right person for it, I think that would help a little bit. And we try to do that by telling
stories that bring that to life so that.
Yes.
So Recruiter Magazine has an aspirational quality to it, and you feel like, hey, I'm actually part of some, it makes you feel like this is a real industry that I should be proud of. So
yes.
I think that's, a huge achievement that you should be proud of.
Well, we keep working away in it, you know, but there's always a story to tell. In a blog I did this week on LinkedIn, I referenced a recruitment agency that's kind of big and they do global business, but what they were doing to reskill people so that they could do jobs that, you know, where people were needed to do the jobs and there weren't people around. I just thought it was phenomenal. The name of that company is VHR.
Okay, I've heard of them.
And they work with aviation companies around the world. And, you know, they trained people, they upskilled people to do things on aircraft. I think that's wonderful.
That's brilliant.
And I think that upskilling has got to be part of the recruiter mission, the recruiter identity, as we go forward into an era where jobs are changing and
definitely
going away. And we haven't quite realized this yet in any great numbers. But
so this links back to our conversation about AI, because the reports that are coming out of, you know, McKinsey and Deloitte and so on predicts like tens of millions of jobs being disrupted. Of course, there's also millions of jobs being created, but they're different jobs,
yes,
right? And so what happens to all the people who were doing the old jobs? So it's really interesting. Have you interviewed Simon LaFosse from LaFosse Associates at Recruiter?
I have not spoken with him, but I know him.
Definitely worth getting him, you know, speaking to him at some stage. So he's been on my podcast before. Something he's doing that's interesting is they have another company which is doing exactly what you're talking about with upskilling. So they are essentially sponsoring and training young people to develop the skills that where there is a shortage,
yes,
because they're a technology recruiter, right? And there's not enough people with certain skills. So they are getting involved in actually training young people in those skills and then placing them with their client companies. It's really cool what they're doing.
Reskill, redeploy, and there's something else. There's a three-word process for it,
okay,
and I don't remember. Retrain, redeploy. Anyway, yes, that is something that is just so important. And we mentioned the young people here. We have got to be thinking about mid-career or late-career people who also don't want to go and knit.
Right, 100%.
And I think that recruiters are so well placed to do that. I don't think you can rely on the government to do everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this will involve, you know, you can take it a step further and say this could be a right answer to for neurologically diverse people.
Okay, absolutely.
Because there are real challenges there.
Yes.
And finding them employers that can work with their specific diversity challenge, you know, dyslexia, et cetera, et cetera. And I aspire for the recruiters to take that step further and be known for that too, you know?
Didi, I feel like we could talk for hours.
Yes, yes.
Was there anything that you'd wanted to share while we're together that we haven't already covered?
Well, I'll speak really quickly. I want stories to tell. Enter the Recruiter Awards so that I can see what you're doing, so that I can share the word of your innovation. I do read all the entries. I'm not a judge. I'm the chair of the judges, but I'm not a judge. But I need to see what's going on so that I have stories to tell, pick up on trends, etc. So do that. Also, be an optimist about where we're going. And I think that's it for now.
Yeah, I think recruiters are optimists. Otherwise, you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning, right? Whoa. Because there's so many. That's why I called it the resilient recruiter, right? The show, because you take a lot of hits in this business.
Yes.
And it is tough. So I think, you know, it does tend to attract people who are optimists by nature, because you get slammed down a lot and you have to be able to pick yourself back up. But I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic about 2025. Thank you so much, Dee Dee, for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This has been great fun.
Great. Awesome. Enjoy the rest of the expo.
Thank you.